Hello, I'm Mickey Mickelson. This is number 0531, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0531. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, you'll meet BBC foreign correspondent Humphrey Hawksley, who is the author of a political thriller called Man on Ice. Humphrey manages to be both a journalist and a best-selling novelist.
I like to do both because when you go into a military base or a conflict situation or an obscure place and you talk to the people to do journalism, I think you get a lot more out of it than that sort of, it stews away, it cooks, it simmers, it boils over the next few months, and from that you get what I hope is quite a credible plot for fiction.
Dr. Jacob M. Appel is the author of Who Says You're Dead? Medical and Ethical Dilemmas for the Curious and Concerned. He discusses medical ethics, which can be a very revealing ride.
Yeah, I think we're at the forefront of a scientific revolution or series of revolutions, and it's hard for ethics to keep up. A really good example I always use is many of your listeners may be in the car driving to work or at work. I ask them, how many of them have locked their doors? And all of them would say yes. How many of them have tested their doorknobs for DNA? And they'll all look at me like I'm crazy. But I can harvest that DNA and use it for all sorts of purposes, finding out their genetic history, whether their father is really their father, and it's illegal in many jurisdictions.
Eli Brown is the founder and CEO of the inspirational fashion brand Shine the Light On. This is a clothing line that grew out of his own struggles with mental illness and addiction.
I wanted to create a platform for youth to share their story, as well as a way to fundraise for nonprofits around the world who are helping youth who are struggling with mental health and addiction. So for me, I thought that the best way to get my message across was to do it on clothing. So I printed the first shirt, and it said the things that make me different make me. And we got a lot of interest in that shirt, and it sold out almost right away. And then we kept coming up with more and more designs and more styles and more colors. And honestly, before I knew it, we were all across Canada and the U.S.
And there's lots and lots of Stuff File news and, of course, an idiot of the day. The guest later, the person who told you this was show number 0531, was Mickey Mickelson, who runs a PR firm called Creative Edge, which has helped to book guests on this show. You can visit his website at creative-edge.com. Services. That's creative-edge.services. And of course, you can easily find the link to that site by going to the page number for this show, which you just heard Mickey mention. As I mentioned, Mickey is a book guest on this program, so I thank him for doing the guest slate and also for the services that Creative Edge offers to people like me. Thank you very much, Mickey, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program, a show that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? A New York product design company, MSCHF, has introduced a new take on Nike's Air Jordan shoes. Instead of air in the sole for a cushiony walk, they pump the surface full of a different kind of Jordan, water from the Jordan River, which is billed as real holy water. Now, since the shoes thus allow the wearers to walk on water, they're dubbed Jesus shoes, which are marketed with a modified version of the papal seal and sport a crucifix hanging from the laces. The company claims the shoes are a statement about collab culture or collaboration culture, promoting businesses on limited edition shoes which sell briskly to hyperbeasts, that's young adults who want to impress their peers. We wanted to make a statement about how absurd collab culture has gotten, claims the company's head of commerce, Daniel Greenberg. The Jesus shoes are just the first of the company's bi-weekly drops, he says. They made about 24 pairs, and when they dropped, they sold out completely within a few hours at $3,000 a pair. That's $1,500 a foot. Again, another niche product for people who obviously have more dollars than cents. I wonder, since they are sold as Jesus shoes and they do have a crucifix hanging from the laces, would it be blasphemous to call them cross trainers? Yeah. During the summer of 2018, someone robbed 61-year-old Akio Hattori of Tokyo, Japan, of his bicycle saddle. He was so angered by the theft, he told police that he decided to become a serial thief himself until he was caught on surveillance video on August 29th of this year and later arrested. Now, police searching his home said they found 159 bicycle seats. I started stealing out of revenge, Hattori told police. I wanted others to know the feeling. Well, you know, when we use the term an eye for an eye, that doesn't mean you should go around blinding everybody. Yeah. An unidentified woman in Crockett, Texas, was going through posts on Facebook when she saw a post by the Trinity County Sheriff wanting to know if anyone could identify a robber from surveillance photos. The robber had hit a bank in the next county, and she certainly could identify him. It was 30-year-old Heath Edward Bumpus, her fiancé. She convinced Bumpus to turn himself in. He basically stated that he was getting married tomorrow, said Sheriff Woody Wallace, but he didn't have enough money for a wedding ring or to pay for the wedding venue. Bumpus was charged with robbery. You know, I guess the wedding has been called off now, although I think that marriage can work out in the long run. You know, marriages do well when the couple communicates and then men listen to the women. I mean, she did say to turn himself in, and he did. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, I have to start off this story by saying that I really do like going to McDonald's. I do enjoy the food, but I have my limits as to what I'm willing to do when it comes to getting a fast food treat. A Minnesota Department of Corrections sergeant is accused of exchanging McDonald's food for oral sex while driving a female inmate to jail. 53-year-old Randy Allen Beeler was charged on October 17th with third-degree criminal sexual conduct and fourth-degree criminal sexual conduct for the alleged incident that happened along U.S. Highway 52. He was taking the woman from Olmsted County Jail to Hennepin County Jail. In a quote from Kathy Keena, Chief Deputy Attorney for Dakota County, it is a felony under Minnesota law for a correctional officer to engage in sexual acts with a person who is a resident of a jail, prison, detention center, or work release facility, or under supervision of the correctional system. Consent by the individual is not a defense. Criminal activity of this nature is a significant breach of trust. Now, during the transfer, Beeler told the woman he was going to stop for food. She indicated that she would do anything for some food, and Beeler asked if that included coming up into the front seat and fooling around. Yikes! If she would go that far for some fast food, you know what the next question has to be, right?
What would you do for a Klondike bar?
Yeah. Let's get to our first guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Humphrey Hawksley is a foreign correspondent for the BBC who is quite proficient in his understanding and experience of international superpowers. But he has just written a book that is a work of fiction, a contemporary political thriller that takes place in the Arctic North. It's called Man on Ice, and Humphrey joins us via Skype from Brussels to talk about it. Hi, Humphrey.
Hello. Hello. Very good to be with you.
Thanks for being on the program with us. You are still currently working as a venerable BBC correspondent. There are not a lot of people who work as a correspondent and also write fiction. There are a lot of people who have been reporters and journalists and left to write fiction. You still do both.
I do still do both, although I'm doing more of the books, nonfiction and fiction, than the on-the-ground reporting, probably because of my generation, I think. But I like to do both, because when you go into a military base or a conflict situation or an obscure place, and you talk to the people to do journalism, I think you get a lot more out of it than that sort of, it stews away, it cooks, it simmers, it boils over the next few months. And from that, you get what I hope is quite a credible plot for fiction.
I'm finding right now that I think one of the only ones I can think of, besides yourself, who is somebody who writes fiction and is also a working journalist, is Jake Tapper on CNN, who's got a couple of books out now.
Jake, David Ignatius also does it at the Washington Post. He did Body of Lies some years ago. He still has a column on the Washington Post. The most famous guy that did it was Frederick Forsyth, but he actually ended up getting sacked from the BBC and then had to write The Day of the Jackal in about a month in order to make ends meet. But in Britain, he was a sort of laid out the benchmark when I was growing up of the guy that was a foreign correspondent and then wrote a best-selling thriller.
There was also George Orwell.
There was George Orwell, too, with 1984, wasn't there? He's
exactly.
Now got a statue outside the BBC, although he hated being in there because it was a sort of lines of people with headphones on even in those days. Well, you know what it's like.
Absolutely.
Churning out the news. He said, I can't be part of this. So he vanished to the Outer Hebrides in Scotland to write 1984 and the rest of it.
So tell us about Man on Ice. As I said, it's a political thriller. It takes place in the Arctic North, which is something that I think is more and more in the news, especially with global warming and everyone wanting that passage up there and the minerals that are underneath the ocean floor, or underneath the ocean. So tell us about Man on Ice.
Well, I mean, as we were saying, I was doing a reporting assignment for the BBC. Well, I have to admit, I sort of found it myself. And it was when Ukraine was kicking off in 2014, and Russia and the US and the West were all at each other's throats again, and there was this fear. I thought, well, let me go somewhere different. And then you open the Atlas, and that ringing phrase from Sarah Palin was in my head, Alaskans can see Russia from their backyards, which she got ridiculed with. So I opened the Atlas and I saw that actually in the Bering Strait off Alaska, there are two islands. One is called Big Diomede and one is called Little Diomede. And these are barely 2 miles apart. And the Big Diomede Island is a Russian military base. And Little Diomede Island is a village of 80 people living there, and they're in American territory, and there's a stretch of water between them. And with all the rhetoric going around at that time, and Russia was sort of planting its flag in Crimea and putting flags at the bottom of the Arctic and ocean to claim land for the future and that sort of thing, I said, well, what would happen if the Russians just flew in and took this island and raised the Russian flag? What would happen? And I asked this question around the intelligence and defense communities in Washington and in Brussels here in NATO and the rest of it, and up in NORAD, which is the Joint Canadian-U.S. Command up in Alaska. It was interesting. Oh, of course, we would do something. Nobody ever thought it would happen. And I said, well, the Argentines did it in the Falklands, so these things do happen. And I thought, well, you've got to do a thriller out of it. And, sort of tell the story in a thriller. So that's how it begins. And the Man on Ice essentially it's a double entendre, really, because you have the man, the hero, Reiko Zenner, is the hero that comes from this island of Little Diomede, move going across the ice to stop the Russians and cut off the snake's head, as he calls it, at the other end. And also man on ice, in that we now have this sort of strange mix of geopolitics that's going on at the moment that we can all feel around us. Mankind on ice. What are we, what are we doing? Where are we going? And everything like that. And that's what came out of it. And I've just finished a sequel to that that's coming out, I think, in North America in March next year, called Man on Edge. Hmm. And I've shifted it up to the Norway-Russian border, so to put it, the similar sort of stuff, same characters, but on the other side of that Arctic belt that you were talking about at the beginning.
In order to write a political thriller like this, you have to do a certain amount of research. And I'm just curious to know how different the research process is for you in writing a work of fiction as opposed to doing the research and digging up stories when you're an investigative or foreign correspondent.
Well, that's a great question. I think essentially I got the idea, if we go back to Man on Ice, because I actually went there, and it's a difficult place to get to. And I got stranded there for a week, or longer than a week, because the fog had set in and I couldn't get out. So I had that nub of stuff there. Then what I do is, with that idea that I know's got credible legs, as it were, I will write the story. And then when you write the story, you mark down those bits that you need to know about more of, and go out and check. You know, how do you do a forensic thing? What happens in the White House on this occasion and that? And only when you've actually written the story do I actually go and chase those detailed bits out. What I find is that if you don't do that, you can actually start doing a bit of research, then you end up going down a rabbit hole because the research is so fascinating, but it's got nothing to do with what you're writing.
One of the reasons I asked earlier about the idea of you being a working journalist and also writing fiction is, when it comes to the geopolitics of the world today, we know countries like China and Russia really don't have a sense of humor. They're very thin-skinned. And do you have to worry?
No, you're right. Yeah. In fact, just as we were doing that hello on Skype just now,
right,
I was writing a piece about how thin-skinned China is. China's just had its 70th anniversary, and you've had these protests in Hong Kong that have been going on for 5 months, and it doesn't seem to have that sort of sure-footedness or flexibility of imagination or whatever it takes to handle something like that, whereas we do, because we're discussing this all the time. You and I could be talking probably against each other or for each other on a number of issues, but it will be out there and discussed. But these guys don't do that. That's why your question made me chuckle a bit.
Which to my point is, as a foreign correspondent, do you ever concern, or are you ever worried about, oh, gee, now I have to go into some of these countries that I've written about in fiction? And, you know, let's face it, in fiction, the Russians and the Chinese usually come out as villains. So
yeah, they do. Well, you've always got your good Russian or your good Chinese, yeah. like you have your good German, I guess.
Yeah. So do you worry that your success as a novelist can hamper sometimes your work as a foreign correspondent if you have to deal with some of the countries you write about?
Yes, that's in the back of your mind. The first one I did, when I was the Beijing bureau chief for the BBC in the late 90s, I did a book called Dragon Strike, which was a fictional account of China starting a war in the South China Sea, which it's sort of doing now. But it's interesting because on the ground, the people that you're dealing with, you get to know them and all the rest of it, unless they get an order from up high to expel you or stop you doing stuff, life just goes on as normal. I think there are instances, and there are places that I would not go to, like Iran, for example, where they tend to be picking people up and throwing them to jail straight away at the moment. But I think it's that sort of sixth sense that you gather over years of reporting as to how far you can push something. But at this stage, I don't think I would ever not write a thriller because I never wanted to go to Russia or China again. I think that you write the thriller and then you pick up the pieces afterwards.
As a working correspondent, how do you find the time, or how do you carve out time to do the creative writing process? What's your time like?
I guess it's getting up early. I mean, I think probably too much detail than anybody wants, but you get up and start writing at 6 when your mind is fresh. By this time it's 9 or 10, you're written out anyway. So anything you write after that is going to be quite late. And then you can pick up the phone and start calling people. And if you're doing nonfiction or reporting, it must be a different section of your brain. In fact, I might Google that when we're off this call, that the imaginative part is in one section and then the sort of factual reporting part is in another. And then if that's done and I've got an hour in the evening, I'll go back and look over the stuff that I've written during those early hours of the morning and do a few edits and stuff like that. It doesn't always work like that. And the key thing, I think, from being a journalist is the deadline. So if the publisher gives me a deadline of, say, March the 1st to get a book in, I try to get it, tell myself it's got to be in by February the 1st. And that allows for all those sort of things to go wrong in the months before it happens. You keep it on track.
Well, continued success with your writing and also your journalism. It's lucky to have two fully fledged, fully formed occupations that meld together this way. The book is called Man on Ice. People can find out more information by going to your website, which is humphreyhoxley.com. Humphrey, I thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Peter. It's been a great privilege. And I hope we talk again over the years or months to come.
Humphrey Hoxley, author of Man on Ice. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0531, and you'll find links to Humphrey's site, plus links to either amazon.com or amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Sign up and find out about our rewards program. Being a patron doesn't have to be a long-term commitment. There's absolutely no obligation. You could join today and end whenever you'd like, but the time we have your support would be so greatly appreciated. We'd also love to hear your thoughts about the show and even your ideas for rewards. Join us for the ride. Join us at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's radio that puts a smile on your face and a skip in your step. Please avoid skipping if you are driving.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk about medical ethics. Plus, we'll meet the founder and CEO of Shine the Light On. That's a clothing apparel where some of the proceeds go to help causes that deal with mental illness. We also have an idiot of the day coming your way a little later on in the program, and much more Stuff File news here on a show that is heard everywhere, including on Stitcher and TuneIn, and can also be heard via Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify. Just click on the Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, or Spotify buttons located on the website at thestufffile.com. And whichever platform you listen to the program on, please feel free to leave a review of the show on their site and also subscribe to the show on their site. It would be greatly appreciated. Well, let's get back to the stuff, shall we? A journalist in Australia received a pitch story from an insurance broker. The subject line: insurance for deadly selfies. It left Casey Edwards sputtering, pointing out in her resulting article that indeed death by selfie is a thing, with 259 people known to have been killed taking selfies through to November of 2017. And as Edwards says, I can only assume that there have been many more since. Well, Casey, if you had been listening to this show in the past, you would have heard several of them. Anyway, she goes on to say there is even a word for it now, killfie. After mocking the whole idea of such insurance, Edwards didn't name the company that made the pitch to her. Either we have reached peak stupidity, Edwards said, or the insurance industry has found a new way to monetize our narcissism. Well, you know, the great thing about the insurance industry is they found a way to combine both. That's also one of the reasons why in the last couple of years there have been a bumper crop of Darwin file stories to choose from on this show. Speaking of which, time now for the Darwin file.
I am the Grim Reaper. I am death.
21-year-old Steve Torres was messing around with a Colt 45 pistol in Durango, Colorado. A friend suggested, "Would you put it away?" To which Torres responded, "It's not loaded, see?" And he put the gun to his head and pulled the trigger. "It was pretty evident what happened," said La Plata County Coroner Jan Smith, who was called to the scene for the death investigation. But she didn't seem to be sure as to how to classify his death. "I'm not sure it would be classified as a suicide," she said. Well, may we suggest a new classification? How about oblivicide, derived from the word obliviate, as in an idiot action sending someone to oblivion? Because, as we've often said on the show, the tree of life is often self-pruning.
I have come for you.
An unidentified man in Phoenix became angry at his upstairs neighbor for making too much noise on October the 6th. He first tried banging on their door at around 11:20 p.m., but then returned to his apartment and fired several shots into his ceiling, one of which apparently ricocheted and hit him in the face. Although no one else was injured, the shooter was taken to the hospital in extremely critical condition. Well, at least he'll enjoy some peace and quiet while he's in the hospital, with the possible exception of the medical staff laughing when they read his chart. Okay, one of the taboos for stories on this show over the years, because we like to keep things light and breezy, is I don't usually share stories about sexual abuse of women. But I am breaking that rule to share this next story as a cautionary tale for you folks out there in the social media sphere. A fan figured out where 21-year-old Japanese pop star Anna Matsuoka lives, followed her through her front door, put a cloth over her mouth, and assaulted her. Now, I'm not going to go into any details here. I just think it's important to mention how the perpetrator, 26-year-old Hibiki Sato, found her. And by the way, he was arrested and confessed to his crimes. Now, Sato says he's a big fan of the singer and found the neighborhood where Matsuoka lives by zooming in on her eye in a selfie that she posted online in high resolution. He matched the look of a reflected train station he spotted in her eye to a Google Street View image, waited for her at that train station, and then followed her home after a concert. Sato was charged with indecent assault, resulting in injury. Okay, if this doesn't creep you out, nothing will. This is a cautionary tale to remind you to be careful of what you post, especially if you're someone in the public eye. If you don't want stalkers to be able to find you, don't post any hints. And that includes whatever is reflected in your eye. I'm just sharing this story as a public service. There are no jokes here, okay? And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, remember the show To Catch a Predator? The great thing about that show was the predator always came to you. Some even traveled great distances. That's what this next story reminds me of, but it does have a long-distance twist. 32-year-old Tommy Lee Jenkins recently moved away from Oshkosh, Wisconsin to Whitestown, Indiana, but on October the 1st, he struck up an online relationship with Kylie, and I'm doing air quotes here because we all know Kylie ain't real, okay? A supposed 14-year-old girl in Neenah, Wisconsin. As their correspondence progressed, He requested sexually explicit photos of Kylie and made plans to engage in sexual behavior. But when Kylie refused to come to Indiana, Jenkins set out toward Nina on foot. On foot. Waiting for him at the end of his 371-mile trek. Let me repeat that. 371 miles on foot were Winnebago County Sheriff deputies, one of whom was Kylie, and also FBI agents who arrested him for using a computer to attempt to persuade, induce, or entice a minor to engage in unlawful sexual activity. Jenkins faced other child sexual assault charges in 2011 and 2012 and had been sentenced to probation only. Well, I'm guessing this time he's gone a mile too far for the judge when it comes to this trial. I mean, a member of the Proclaimers, he ain't.
But I would walk 500 miles, and I would walk 500 more to beat a man who walked 1,000 miles to fall down at your door.
And let's get to our next guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Dr. Jacob M. Appel is a celebrated bioethicist who is the author of Who Says You're Dead? Medical and Ethical Dilemmas for the Curious and Concerned. It's a book that asks readers to play doctor and decide what they would do if confronted with a dilemma. Dr. Appel joins us on the line from New York. Hi, Jacob.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Thanks for being on the program with us. You have been at this game for a long time. You have worked as a doctor. You have worked as a teacher. So you have followed the ethics of your profession. The reason why I bring that up is because from the time you decided this was going to be your field to today, do you find we are on a slippery slope when it comes to ethics, with the fact that ethics seems to sometimes be neck and neck in a race with medical advances? And if so, is winning?
Yeah, I think we're at the forefront of a scientific revolution or series of revolutions, and it's hard for ethics to keep up, and hard for law to keep up. A really good example I always use is many of your listeners may be in the car driving to work or at work. I ask them, how many of them have locked their doors? And all of them would say yes. How many of them have dusted their doorknobs for DNA? And they'll all look at me like I'm crazy. But I could harvest that DNA and use it for all sorts of purposes, finding out their genetic history, whether their father is really their father, and it's illegal in many jurisdictions.
Really?
Yeah, gene theft is legal, certainly in the majority of American states.
Now, is it something that is it legal because no laws have been made and it's something that's overlooked, or is it purposely legal?
Oh, no, it's legal because it's largely been overlooked. It's one of those areas where we simply, the ethics and the law have not caught up with the evolving technology.
So is it part of your goal, and again with this book, is it part of your goal to bring this to the forefront so that either the general population or lawmakers are aware of what's not being done?
That's a portion. Most of it is to give people impetus and opportunity to think about these complex issues. But what I tell people is, bioethicists like myself are great people to meet at parties or weddings, but you don't want to meet us in the hospital. And the best way to avoid that is thinking through lots of these questions in advance.
Wow. So in writing this book, do you feel, or in talking to people at a party or a gathering, do the things that you say, do they comfort people or make them aware of the situation, or do they scare people?
I think mostly they surprise people. People think that these ethical issues are fairly cut and dry. They know what they think about a handful of very basic issues. And then you raise some complex scenario, and they have no idea what to do with it. And it only takes a little bit of thinking for them to figure out at least what their values are relating to it. But you got to prepare in advance. I can give an example if that's helpful.
Please.
So a good example I always use is the case of a patient who brings his father to the hospital because they want to see if they're a match for a kidney donation, and there's bad news and there's worse news. The bad news is they're not a match, and the worst news is they're not father and son. Should the hospital share this with them, with one, with both? Because it has significant family implications if you do share, but the son will be mistaken about his genetic history if he doesn't share and may then not get screened for diseases that could kill him.
Okay, so what is the answer to that question? I feel the hospital should, but maybe I'm wrong.
So I rarely in the book offer right answers. I just offer different ways of thinking about it. But I tell those people who say, well, obviously they should. Here's another example that is more challenging. A husband and wife come forward. They are past childbearing age. The hospital discovers not only are they related, but they are, not only are they matches, but they are siblings. Should the hospital ruin their marriage when there's not as much of a clear medical benefit, but possibly some?
Wow. Wow. Okay, that is a difficult one, because as you're saying, they're past childbearing age, so the thought of them having a child is not in the, in the equation. But, I guess...
No easy answers.
Well...
No easy answers.
I guess the question has to be asked, is the couple, even though they're unaware that they're brother and sister, are indeed brother and sister, are they not, by definition, breaking a law? And if they are breaking a law, doesn't the hospital have to express that fact?
Not always. I mean, certainly we have to inform patients or inform the authorities when people are posing a danger to themselves or others. Is breaking this law really a danger of that level? It's sort of like if we discover a patient has a traffic ticket, we don't turn them in.
Wow. You must be a hot ticket at dinner parties.
People try to stay as far away from me as possible. I put a damper on the evening.
I'm surprised, because I would find that this would bring, I mean, especially in the world we live in today, where everything seems to be so hotly divided on political spectrums, the things that you're bringing up are actual everyday things. And yes, maybe politics could be involved in one way, shape, or form, but they would bring, I would think, more meaty debate than your typical who's on the right and who's on the left.
Well, that's my hope. And my other goal, and really the whole goal of my work in ethics and my project, is to help people understand the people who disagree with them are not evil people. They just start with different premises and come to different conclusions. And you're never going to change people's minds on these issues unless you understand where they're coming from.
Well, I was about to ask, do you come across people when you talk about these things where you possibly can change their mind, or at the very least have them confused where they can't make up their mind?
Absolutely. I think often the way to do that is not to challenge them, but on the one hand, to give them more information. People do value information. And also, many people I've discovered want permission. On the one hand, they want permission to make the medical choices they think are right and want sort of a secular blessing. But they also want permission to sort of explore things in a more complex way. And our society affords people very little opportunity for that.
Now, in addition to being a doctor, you also are a teacher. So I'm just wondering, is it more important for you to bring up these ethical dilemmas, not necessarily with the general population, but those who are going to be physicians themselves, or those who currently are physicians?
Oh, absolutely. And my key goal, I tell the medical students on day one, I'm not going to teach you all of medical ethics. You're not going to become professional ethicists or lawyers. What you need to do is to be able to recognize a challenging ethical issue so you can call experts who can help you. Because if you don't see it as an ethical problem, you're never going to come to the right answer.
Are these situations that people sometimes don't realize or consider through the course of their daily lives? And I'm talking here about those in the medical profession. In other words, you as someone who is a teacher, who teaches ethics, is it possible for you to come across an ethical dilemma that you hadn't considered? In other words, is there a fork in the road for you somewhere that is out there somewhere?
Oh, absolutely. Every day in the hospital, when I think I've sort of thought through all the complex permutations of things, somebody will always surprise me by pointing out another pathway I hadn't thought about or unintended consequence.
What was the last time you were considered surprised?
Last time I was considered surprised. I mean, I guess the honest answer is I'm surprised every day. One very concrete example I always give is when I'm surprised that other people are surprised. It's when they talk to me about getting genetic testing for finding out their risk of Alzheimer's disease. And I tell them, well, you can do that, but not only will you discover your risk, you'll discover portions of your parents' risk. Do you want to tell them this or don't you? And people are suddenly dumbfounded. And there's no easy answer to that either.
Which brings us to another point. You mentioned genetic testing. There's a lot of that going on. There's all this interest in finding your roots. There's all this interest in checking your DNA. Do you think generally, and I don't know if you can put a percentage to this, is that a good idea or a bad idea?
I think a better way to phrase it is, it can be a very powerful tool and very useful, but people have to really understand what they're getting into and the risks as well. And I think most people understand the very visceral, tangible benefit. They can figure out who their ancestors were. They don't really understand all of the complex implications and risks. For example, when you show up to buy long-term care insurance in the United States, they can use those results against you.
Wow. And I guess it also depends on the psyche of the individual. Like, I often see stories about people who are overly concerned about finding out information and wondering how it affects who they actually are. If I were to discover, for instance, there were axe murders in my ancestry, my feeling is, well, that's fine. That's not me. But some people are really upset about this idea that could happen in their family.
Yeah, one of the most remarkable phenomena is that people often get tested if they have family histories of severe genetic disorders to see whether they're going to come down with them later on in life. And the people who test negative, often who are not going to get the disease, often have more psychologically negative consequences than those who test positive and find out they will get the disease, because they experience survivor guilt when they have family members who died and they don't.
Does it also make it difficult with all this information to actually find the person you're best suited for to mate? In other words, it becomes too clinical, becomes too medical in the dating process.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you should date people the same way you buy a house or choose a career. You should ignore all the data and go in your gut instinct and you're end up much happier.
I think we'll end it on that note. The book is Who Says You're Dead? Medical and Ethical Dilemmas for the Curious and Concerned. By the way, why the title, Who Says You're Dead?
Because death is not an obvious answer. Some states recognize brain death, others don't. So if your relative is legally dead in the state, but you don't think they're dead, the question arises, can you take them home on life support and keep them sustained, if not alive?
Wow. Fascinating topic indeed. And again, I think you'd be a great dinner guest because I could talk to you for hours. I thank you very, very much for being on the program with us.
My pleasure. Anytime.
Dr. Jacob M. Appel, author of Who Says You're Dead? Medical and Ethical Dilemmas for the Curious and Concerned. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0531, and you'll find links to Jacob's site, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
Got something for the mailbag? Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. Send your email to mailbag@thestufffile.com. And remember, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H. That's mailbag@thestufffile.com. Or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Often I mention my book, Great Conversations, my interviews with two men on the moon and a galaxy of stars. I also often mention that I'd like you to become a patron of the Stuff File program via Patreon.com. Well, this is my opportunity to combine both of those pleas to you. You've heard me say on many occasions about the myriad of celebrities I've had the chance to talk to that are contained in my book, which is published by Bear Manor Media. You've also heard me mention that some of the celebrities in my book, and many others, can be heard on our page at Patreon.com. Well, if you've been on the fence about joining Patreon, let me try to pull you over to our side. By becoming a patron, you help to make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. And if you do become a regular patron, as a Patreon reward, I'll share with you an electronic version of my book for your e-reader. So join Patreon and claim your copy of Great Conversations, my interviews with two men on the moon and a galaxy of stars. Sign up today at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram.
Listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's radio that's now gluten-free.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk to the founder and CEO of Shine the Light On. Plus, we do indeed have an idiot of the day coming your way. And I got one more Stuff File news story I want to share with you here on a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. And it's also available on Spotify. In El Dorado Hills, California, owner Matthew Eschrich woke up late on October the 12th, saw a sensor light on next to his garage, and went downstairs to investigate. When he heard rumbling, he realized there was an intruder and called 911. Just then, his sister-in-law, who also lives in the home, called to say that she had just pulled into the garage and saw a man running away wearing just a bra and panties. The intruder was later identified as 37-year-old Sean McGuire, a transient who was taken into custody and charged with burglary, indecent exposure, and trespassing. Okay, not to split hairs here, but as you know, going topless as a male has never been a crime, and he was wearing a bra. The panties would have covered his naughty bits, and unless it was a thong, and I've seen the pictures, then his butt cheeks would have also been covered. So, odd as it was, I can understand the burglary charge and the trespassing charge, but how has his wardrobe choice risen to the level of indecent exposure? Unless, of course, the undies he pilfered were white, since this took place after Labor Day. Anyway, let's get to our last guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? And speaking of apparel, Eli Brown is the founder and CEO of the inspirational fashion brand Shine the Light On. It's a company that's billed as clothing that brings a voice to mental health issues impacting youth. The powerful signature t-shirt designs, with simple but positive messages, debuted in just 7 stores across Canada, but can now be found online and in 500 stores across Canada and the U.S. Eli joins us on the line right now from Toronto. Hi, Eli.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks very much for taking the time to be on the program with us. So how did this all come to be? How did this start for you, the company Shine the Light On?
So it was kind of an interesting path to get there because I never grew up wanting to be in the clothing industry. But after going through my own struggle with mental health and addiction, I wanted to create a platform for youth to share their story, as well as a way to fundraise for nonprofits around the world who are helping youth who are struggling with mental health and addiction. So for me, I thought that the best way to get my message across was to do it on clothing. So I printed the first shirt, and it said the things that make me different make me. And we got a lot of interest in that shirt, and it sold out almost right away. And then we kept coming up with more and more designs and more styles and more colors. And honestly, before I knew it, we were all across Canada and the U.S.
Now, you say you weren't into the clothing business. This was not something you were initially interested in. But were you entrepreneurial? What were you doing before you did this?
So before, I was actually playing competitive tennis. I started playing tennis at the age of 3 and made my way on the Team Canada and played all across the world. Took a scholarship to the University of Michigan. And basically that took up 7 days a week of my time all the way up until I was about 20 years old.
So you had a pretty decent life. And again, when we're talking about mental illness, I'm sure you're aware of some of the stigmas that are out there and misconceptions that are out there about people who have to deal with mental illness. And one of the things I'm sure you've heard about is, well, gee, you were a tennis star and you were doing this and you were doing that. What do you have to be upset about?
Yeah, so that was one of the biggest struggles I had with sharing my story and reaching out for help, was that from a surface level, everything in my life was going extremely well. I was traveling all around the world. I was playing a sport that I loved. I was going to a great university. So when I reached out about my struggles, it was very difficult to get the support that I needed because my life seemed perfect from the outside.
What about your friends and family, particularly your family? Were they aware of what was happening to you? Were they on your side, or did some of them have also reservations about what you were going through?
Yeah, so everyone in my family was extremely supportive and obviously still is to this day. It was just that since I had so many positive things going on around me, and I don't fault them for this, they thought that I was just going through a tough time. And that this wasn't something deeper like a depression or anxiety. They just thought, you know, I was a young kid. I was traveling, waking up super early, practicing all day, then going to school, then back to practice, trying to balance a social life. So they really just thought that how I was feeling was typical of anybody else who was going through a really intense schedule.
So now you continue to be successful. You have this fashion brand called Shine the Light On. When it comes to physical issues, whether somebody has cancer or they've had a heart attack or whatever other physical ailment comes along, people don't necessarily hearken back to the situation that they had in their past. But when it comes to mental illness, some people will say, oh, well, gee, he's crazy. He's whatever. There's a stigma that lingers even after you've had help. Do you find that's an issue you have to deal with as well?
A little bit, but not too much. And I think a lot of that comes from that so many people now are talking about mental health, and a lot of people are really coming forward and sharing their own experience. And I think as people are doing that, it is decreasing the stigma. I think there is still some there, but it's, I think overall it's a much more positive reaction that people have after someone has gone through their journey and come through the other side.
As for your journey, they often say that somebody has to hit rock bottom. What was rock bottom for you?
So for me, it was, I felt like I couldn't go a day without using substances. No matter what I did or no matter what I had around me, I felt alone, I felt isolated, and I felt like I couldn't continue. There truly wasn't a day that I didn't feel depressed and anxious and that I couldn't really continue. I also started to lose interest in all the things that I once loved. I fell out of touch with a lot of my family members and friends and really just isolated myself. But for me, you know, after a couple suicide attempts, that to me was my rock bottom.
So what was the first step in turning yourself around?
So the first step for me was I reached out for help. Throughout my journey of struggling, there were a lot of people who were asking to help me, but I was very reluctant to that just because I hadn't hit my rock bottom and I really didn't have that realization that I had to get help. I thought I could work through it on my own. But once I did reach out for help, I started to build my support system and the people around me, and I started to go see doctors and therapists and really start to get my life back on track.
So getting back to your company, I understand some of the proceeds go to charity. What charities do they go to, and how did you decide to do that aspect of Shine the Light On?
So right now what we're doing is we donate 10% of the proceeds to an organization called Mindfulness Without Borders, and they teach social and emotional learning to youth around the world. It really just helps them be able to navigate life and provide them with skills that they need to mitigate stress and anxiety and some mental health difficulties that they may face growing up. And then we also take an additional 40% of the proceeds and we put it towards an organization called NOBA, which builds affordable housing for youth impacted by mental health and addiction.
Excellent. Now, as I mentioned in the introduction, you started off doing this in just 7 stores across Canada, and now you're in 500 in Canada and the U.S. How did the company grow so big, and were you anticipating that this was going to happen?
So I definitely was not anticipating that this was going to happen. I thought that this was just going to be a hobby, something to keep myself busy for a couple of months. I never anticipated it for it to get this big. But really what we did was we just worked extremely hard. We went door to door with our product, showing anyone who would listen, calling and emailing almost every store under the sun. And we were having great sell-through in the stores that we were in. The word was getting around, that product was going really well, and it just kept building day after day.
And where do you see it going in the future? Where, now that you've had this success, how big can you get?
So my goal with this is obviously to take this around the world. We want this to be available in every store and available in every country to really raise awareness around the world for mental health. And then as we continue to do that, I do believe that we will start to shine the light on other social issues that are impacting youth around the world.
And what do you think still needs to happen for the conversation about mental health to move forward?
So I think there still needs to be continued dialogue about mental health, the signs, the symptoms, that that people can face, because I think we're very fortunate here in Canada that the conversation has really developed and a lot of people are aware about mental health and where they can go for help and the educational resources behind it. But there are a lot of countries around the world that are lacking in that. So I think that just needs to really continue to grow, and hopefully we can be a crucial role in that.
You mentioned that there are a lot of sayings that are on the various articles of clothing that you sell. What's your most popular?
It changes month after month, but overall, our favorite design and our most popular design, it says, "Rather be in bed." And that was a design done by a young girl who was facing depression. And when we heard her story, she kept saying that she would rather be in bed on those days where she felt dark and gloomy. So that really resonated with us, and that's what we put on one of our sweaters. And we've had that on sale since day one, and it's by far our best one.
Well, congratulations on the success of your company. Again, it's called Shine the Light On, and people can find out more information by going to your website, which is shinethelighton.com. Eli, I thank you very much for being on the show with us.
Thank you so much for having me. It was great speaking to you today.
Eli Brown, founder and CEO of the inspirational fashion brand Shine the Light On. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check the show number for this program, which is show number 0531, and you'll find the link to Eli's website. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Time now for The Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for The Strange Things Adults Do. The Stuff File presents The Idiot of the Day.
Again and again, the Manila, Arkansas homeowner, having been roused at about 3 a.m. by a loud noise, ordered the intruder to leave at gunpoint. The intruder responded first by getting himself some food from the homeowner's kitchen, then by unplugging the TV. Eventually, the intruder said, "Give me that gun before you hurt yourself, old man." Mississippi County Sheriff's deputies found 47-year-old Charles Lancaster across the street and called for an ambulance. He'd been shot in the leg. After hospital treatment, he was booked into jail. Now, why? Oh, why? Would you break into someone's house in the middle of the night, make noise, take food from the kitchen, and refuse to leave, and then taunt them about the gun they're holding on you? One reason, and one reason only. You're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program number 0531. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links and all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0531. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder, and don't forget to check us out on Patreon.com, or you can become a patron of the program. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, GDPR Revolution 99, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on Apple or Google Podcasts, streaming on Spotify and Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. If you were listening to this at the same time as watching The Wizard of Oz and listening to Pink Floyd's The Dark Side of the Moon, well, it's a waste of electricity. There are some things you just can't multitask.